This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, May 17, 1907, Chapters from My Autobiography, Chapter 18, by Mark Twain. Dictated December 21, 1906. I wish to insert here some pages of Susie's biography of me, in which the biographer does not scatter, according to her custom, but sticks pretty steadily to a single subject until she has fought it to a finish. February 27, 1886. Last summer, while we were in Elmira, an article came out in the Christian Union by name, What Ought He to Have Done?, treating of the government of children, or rather giving an account of a father's battle with his little baby boy, by the mother of the child, and put in the form of a question as to whether the father disciplined the child correctly or not. Different people wrote their opinions of the father's behavior, and told what they thought he should have done. Mama had long known how to discipline children, for in fact the bringing up of children had been one of her specialties for many years. She had a great many theories, but one of them was that if a child was big enough to be naughty, it was big enough to be whipped, and here we all agreed with her. I remember one morning when Dr. Blank came up to the farm. He had a long discussion with Mama upon the following topic. Mama gave this as illustrative of one important rule for punishing a child. She said, "We will suppose the boy has thrown a handkerchief onto the floor. I tell him to pick it up. He refuses. I tell him again. He refuses. Then I say, 'You must either pick up the handkerchief or have a whipping.' My theory is never to make a child have a whipping and pick up the handkerchief too. I say, 'If you do not pick it up, I must punish you.' If he doesn't, he gets the whipping. But I pick up the handkerchief. If he does, he gets no punishment. I tell him to do a thing. If he disobeys me, he is punished for so doing, but not forced to obey me afterwards. When Clara and I had been very naughty, or were being very naughty, the nurse would go and call Mama, and she would appear suddenly and look at us. She had a way of looking at us when she was displeased, as if she could see right through us, till we were ready to sink through the floor from embarrassment and total absence of knowing what to say. This look was usually followed with, 'Clara,' or 'Susie, what do you mean by this? Do you want to come to the bathroom with me?' Then followed the climax, for Clara and I both knew only too well what going to the bathroom meant. But Mama's first and foremost object was to make the child understand that he is being punished for his sake, and because the mother so loves him that she cannot allow him to do wrong, also that it is as hard for her to punish him as for him to be punished, and even harder. Mama never allowed herself to punish us when she was angry with us. She never struck us because she was annoyed at us and felt like striking us if we had been naughty and had annoyed her, so that she thought she felt or would show the least bit of temper toward us while punishing us. She always postponed the punishment until she was no more chafed by our behavior. She never humored herself by striking or punishing us because or while she was the least bit annoyed with us. Our very worst naughtiness were punished by being taken to the bathroom and being whipped by the paper-cutter. But after the whipping was over, Mama did not allow us to leave her until we were perfectly happy and perfectly understood why we had been whipped. I never remember having felt the least bit bitterly toward Mama for punishing me. I always felt I had deserved my punishment and was much happier for having received it. For after Mama had punished us and shown her displeasure, she showed no signs of further displeasure, but acted as if we had not displeased her in any way. Ordinary punishments answered very well for Susie. She was a thinker, and would reason out the purpose of them, apply the lesson, and achieve the reform required. But it was much less easy to devise punishments that would reform Clara. This was because she was a philosopher who was always turning her attention to finding something good and satisfactory and entertaining in everything that came her way. Consequently, it was sometimes pretty discouraging to the troubled mother to find that, after all her pains and thought in inventing what she meant to be a severe and reform-compelling punishment, the child had entirely missed the severities through her native disposition to get interest and pleasure out of them as novelties. The mother, in her anxiety to find a penalty that would take sharp hold and do its work effectively, at last resorted, with a sore heart and with a reproachful conscience, to that punishment which the incorrigible criminal in the penitentiary dreads above all the other punitive miseries which the warden inflicts upon him for his good, solitary confinement in the dark chamber. The grieved and worried mother shut Clara up in a very small clothes-closet, and went away and left her there for 15 minutes. It was all that the mother heart could endure. Then she came softly back and listened for the sobs, but there weren't any. There were muffled and inarticulate sounds, but they could not be construed into sobs. The mother waited half an hour longer. By that time she was suffering so intensely with sorrow and compassion for the little prisoner that she was not able to wait any longer for the distressed sounds which she had counted upon to inform her when there had been punishment enough and the reform accomplished. She opened the closet to set the prisoner free and take her back into her loving favor and forgiveness, but the result was not the one expected. The captive had manufactured a fairy cavern out of the closet, and friendly fairies out of the clothes hanging from the hooks, and was having a most sinful and unrepentant good time, and requested permission to spend the rest of the day there. From Susie's Biography of Me. But Mama's opinions and ideas upon the subject of bringing up children has always been more or less of a joke in our family, particularly since Papa's article in the Christian Union, and I am sure Clara and I have related the history of our old family paper-cutter, our punishments and privations, with rather more pride and triumph than any other sentiment, because of Mama's way of rearing us. When the article, "What Ought He to Have Done?" came out, Mama read it and was very much interested in it, and when Papa heard that she had read it, he went to work and secretly wrote his opinion of what the father ought to have done. He told Aunt Susie, Clara, and I about it, but Mama was not to see it or hear anything about it till it came out. He gave it to Aunt Susie to read, and after Clara and I had gone to get ready for bed, he brought it up for us to read. He told what he thought the father ought to have done by telling what Mama would have done. The article was a beautiful tribute to Mama, and every word in it true. But still, in writing about Mama, he partly forgot that the article was going to be published, I think, and expressed himself more fully than he would do the second time he wrote it. I think the article has done and will do a great deal of good, and I think it would have been perfect for the family and friends' enjoyment, but a little bit too private to have been published as it was. And Papa felt so, too, because the very next day, or a few days after, he went down to New York to see if he couldn't get it back before it was published, but it was too late, and he had to return without it. When the Christian Union reached the farm, and Papa's article in it, all ready and waiting to be read to Mama, Papa hadn't the courage to show it to her, for he knew she wouldn't like it at all, at first. And he didn't, but he might have let it go, and never let her see it. But finally he gave his consent to her seeing it, and told Clara and I we could take it to her, which we did, with tardiness, and we all stood around Mama while she read it, all wondering what she would say and think about it. She was too much surprised, and pleased privately, too, to say much at first, but as we all expected, publicly, or rather when she remembered that this article was to be read by every one that took the Christian Union, she was rather shocked and a little displeased. Clara and I had great fun the night Papa gave it to us to read and then hide, so Mama couldn't see it. For just as we were in the midst of reading it, Mama appeared, Papa following anxiously, and asked why we were not in bed. Then a scuffle ensued, for we told her it was a secret and tried to hide it, but she chased us wherever we went, till she thought it was time for us to go to bed. Then she surrendered, and left us to tuck it under Clara's mattress. A little while after the article was published, letters began to come in to Papa, criticizing it. There were some very pleasant ones, but a few very disagreeable. One of these, the very worst, Mama got hold of and read, to Papa's great regret. It was full of the most disagreeable things, and so very annoying to Papa that he for a time felt he must do something to show the author of it his great displeasure at being so insulted. But he finally decided not to, because he felt the man had some cause for feeling annoyed at, for Papa had spoken of him. He was the baby's father, rather slightingly in his Christian Union article. After all this, Papa and Mama both wished, I think, they might never hear or be spoken to on the subject of the Christian Union article. And whenever any has spoken to me and told me how much they did enjoy my father's article in the Christian Union, I almost laughed in their faces when I remembered what a great variety of opinions had been expressed upon the subject of the Christian Union article of Papa's. The article was written in July or August, and just the other day Papa received quite a bright letter from a gentleman who has read the CU article and gave his opinion of it in these words. "It is missing. She probably put the letter between the leaves of the biography, and it got lost out. She threw away the hostile letters, but tried to keep the pleasantest one for her book. Surely there has been no kindlier biographer than this one. Yet, to a quite creditable degree, she is loyal to the responsibilities of her position as historian, not eulogist, and honorably gives me a quiet prod now and then. But how many, many, many she has withheld that I deserved. I could prize them now. There would be no acid in her words, and it is lost to me that she did not set them all down. Oh, Susie, you sweet little biographer, you break my old heart with your gentle charities. I think a great deal of her work. Her canvases are on their easels, and her brush flies about in a carefree and random way, delivering a dash here, a dash there, and another yonder, and one might suppose that there would be no definite result. On the contrary, I think that an intelligent reader of her little book must find that by the time he has finished it, he has somehow accumulated a pretty clear and nicely shaded idea of the several members of this family, including Susie herself, and that the random dashes on the canvases have developed into portraits. I feel that my own portrait, with some of the defects fined down and others left out, is here, and I am sure that any who knew the mother will recognize her without difficulty, and will say that the lines are drawn with a just judgment and a sure hand. Little creature though Susie was, the penetration which was born in her finds its way to the surface more than once in these pages. Before Susie began the biography, she let fall a remark now and then concerning my character which showed that she had it under observation. In the record which she kept of the children's sayings, there's an instance of this. She was 12 years of age at the time. We had established a rule that each member of the family must bring a fact to breakfast, a fact drawn from a book or from any other source. Any fact would answer. Susie's first contribution was in substance as follows. Two great exiles and former opponents in war met in Ephesus, Scipio and Hannibal. Scipio asked Hannibal to name the greatest general the world had produced. Alexander, and he explained why. And the next greatest? Pyrrhus, and he explained why. But where do you place yourself, then? If I had conquered you, I would place myself before the others. Susie's grave comment was, "That attracted me. It was just like Papa. He is so frank about his books." So frank in admiring them, she meant. Thursday, March 28, 1907. Some months ago I commented upon a chapter of Susie's biography wherein she very elaborately discussed an article about the training and disciplining of children which I had published in the Christian Union. This was 21 years ago, an article which was full of worshipful praises of Mrs. Clemens as a mother, and which little Clara and Susie and I had been hiding from this lovely and admirable mother because we knew she would disapprove of public and printed praises of herself. At the time that I was dictating these comments several months ago, I was trying to call back to my memory some of the details of that article, but I was not able to do it, and I wished I had a copy of the article so that I could see what there was about it which gave it such large interest to Susie. Yesterday afternoon I elected to walk home from the luncheon at the St. Regis, which is in 55th Street and 5th Avenue, for it was a fine spring day, and I hadn't had a walk for a year or two, and felt the need of exercise. As I walked along down 5th Avenue, the desire to see that Christian Union article came into my head again. I had just reached the corner of 42nd Street then, and there was the usual jam of wagons, carriages, and automobiles there. I stopped to let it thin out before trying to cross the street, but a stranger, who didn't require as much room as I do, came racing by and darted into a crack among the vehicles and made the crossing. But on his way past me, he thrust a couple of ancient newspaper clippings into my hand and said, "There, you don't know me, but I have saved them in my scrapbook for 20 years, and it occurred to me this morning that perhaps you would like to see them. So I was carrying them downtown to mail them, I not expecting to run across you in this accidental way, of course, but I will give them into your hands now. Good-bye." And he disappeared among the wagons. Those scraps which he had put into my hand were ancient newspaper copies of that Christian Union article. It is a handsome instance of mental telegraphy, or, if it isn't that, it is a handsome case of coincidence. From the Biography, March 14, 1886. Mr. Lawrence Barrett and Mr. and Mrs. Hutton were here a little while ago, and we had a very interesting visit from them. Papa said Mr. Barrett never had acted so well before when he had seen him as he did the first night he was staying with us, and Mrs. Blank said she never had seen an actor on the stage whom she more wanted to speak with. Papa has been very much interested of late in the mind-cure theory, and in fact so have we all. A young lady in town has worked wonders by using the mind-cure upon people. She is constantly busy now curing people's diseases in this way, and curing her own even, which to me seems the most remarkable of all. A little while past, Papa was delighted with the knowledge of what he thought the best way of curing a cold, which was by starving it. This starving did work beautifully and freed him from a great many severe colds. Now, he says, it wasn't the starving that helped his colds, but the trust in the starving, the mind-cure connected with the starving. I shouldn't wonder if we finally become firm believers in mind-cure. The next time Papa has a cold, I haven't a doubt, he will send for Miss H., the young lady who is doctoring in the mind-cure theory, to cure him of it. Mama was over at Mrs. George Warner's to lunch the other day, and Miss H. was there, too. Mama asked if anything as natural as nearsightedness could be cured. She said, oh, yes, just as well as other diseases. When Mama came home, she took me into her room and told me that perhaps my nearsightedness could be cured by the mind-cure, and that she was going to have me try the treatment anyway. There could be no harm in it, and there might be great good. If her plan succeeds, there certainly will be a great deal in mind-cure, to my opinion, for I am very near-sighted, and so is Mama, and I never expected there could be any more cure for it than for blindness, but now I don't know but what there's a cure for that. It was a disappointment. Her near-sightedness remained with her to the end. She was born with it, no doubt, yet, strangely enough, she must have been 4 years old, and possibly 5, before we knew of its existence. It is not easy to understand how that could have happened. I discovered the defect by accident. I was halfway up the hall stairs one day at home, and was leading her by the hand, when I glanced back through the open door of the dining-room and saw what I thought she would recognize as a pretty picture. It was Stray Kit, the slender, the graceful, the sociable, the beautiful, the incomparable, the cat of cats, the tortoise-shell, curled up as round as a wheel and sound asleep on the fire-red cover of the dining-table, with a brilliant stream of sunlight falling across her. I exclaimed about it, but Susie said she could see nothing there, neither cat nor tablecloth. The distance was so slight, not more than 20 feet, perhaps, that if it had been any other child, I should not have credited the statement. From the Biography, March 14, 1886. Clara sprained her ankle, a little while ago, by running into a tree when coasting, and while she was unable to walk with it, she played solitaire with cards a great deal. While Clara was sick and Papa saw her play solitaire so much, he got very much interested in the game, and finally began to play it himself a little. Then Jean took it up, and at last Mama even played it occasionally. Jean's and Papa's love for it rapidly increased, and now Jean brings the cards every night to the table, and Papa and Mama help her play, and before dinner is at an end, Papa has gotten a separate pack of cards, and is playing alone with great interest. Mama and Clara next are made subject to the contagious solitaire, and there are four solitarians at the table, while you hear nothing but "fill up the place," etc. It is dreadful. After supper, Clara goes into the library and gets a little red mahogany table, and placing it under the gas fixture, seats herself and begins to play again. Then Papa follows with another table of the same description, and they play solitaire till bedtime. We have just had our Prince and Pauper pictures taken, two groups and some little single ones. The groups, the interview and Lady Jane Grey scene, were pretty good. The Lady Jane scene was perfect, just as pretty as it could be. The interview was not so good, and two of the little single pictures were very good indeed, but one was very bad. Yet, on the whole, we think they were a success. Papa has done a great deal in his life, I think, that is good and very remarkable, but I think if he had had the advantages with which he could have developed the gifts which he has made no use of in writing his books, or in any other way for other people's pleasure and benefit outside of his own family and intimate friends, he could have done more than he has, and a great deal more even. He is known to the public as a humorist, but he has much more in him that is earnest than that is humorous. He has a keen sense of the ludicrous, notices funny stories and incidents, knows how to tell them, to improve upon them, and does not forget them. He has been through a great many of the funny adventures related in Tom Sawyer and in Huckleberry Finn himself, and he lived among just such boys and in just such villages all the days of his early life. His Prince and Pauper is his most original and best production. It shows the most of any of his books what kind of pictures are in his mind, usually, not that the picture of England in the 16th century and the adventures of a little prince and pauper are the kind of things he mainly thinks about, but that that book and those pictures represent the train of thought and imagination he would be likely to be thinking of today, tomorrow, or next day, more nearly than those given in Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn. Note, it is so yet. M.T. Papa can make exceedingly bright jokes, and he enjoys funny things, and when he is with people he jokes and laughs a great deal, but still he is more interested in earnest books and earnest subjects to talk upon than in humorous ones. Note, she has said it well and correctly. Humor is a subject which has never had much interest for me. This is why I have never examined it, nor written about it, nor used it as a topic for a speech. 100 times it has been offered me as a topic in these past 40 years, but in no case has it attracted me. M.T. When we are all alone at home, 9 times out of 10 he talks about some very earnest subjects, with an occasional joke thrown in, and he a good deal more often talks upon such subjects than upon the other kind. He is as much of a philosopher as anything, I think. I think he could have done a great deal in this direction if he had studied while young, for he seems to enjoy reasoning out things no matter what. In a great many such directions, he has greater ability than in the gifts which have made him famous. Thus at 14 she had made up her mind about me, and in no timorous or uncertain terms had set down her reasons for her opinion. 15 years were to pass before any other critic, except Mr. Howells, I think, was to re-utter that daring opinion and print it. Right or wrong, it was a brave position for that little analyzer to take. She never withdrew it afterwards, nor modified it. She has spoken of herself as lacking physical courage, and has evinced her admiration of Clara's, but she had moral courage, which is the rarest of human qualities, and she kept it functionable by exercising it. I think that in questions of morals and politics she was usually on my side, but when she was not, she had her reasons and maintained her ground. 2 years after she passed out of my life, I wrote a philosophy. Of 3 persons who have seen the manuscript, only one understood it, and all 3 condemned it. If she could have read it, she also would have condemned it, possibly, probably, in fact, but she would have understood it. It would have had no difficulties for her on that score. Also, she would have found a tireless pleasure in analyzing and discussing its problems. Mark Twain, to be continued.